If my life depends on me dividing a fraction,
oh gosh,
no. I am dead. Yeah, I am absolutely dead.
And it's crazy because I remember we had to like learn it well enough just to pass like the test that required it. And then like all of it, I just completely forgot. Like I never ever retained any of that.
It's I remember having to like redo it in like testing for the GRE.
Ugh, I having to like so much.
Revisit it as a 21-year-old. Ugh,
that was so awful. I totally sabotaged my GRE.
You did?
Yeah, I sabotaged it because like I didn't feel
on purpose.
I didn't feel like I studied enough for it. And like I remember back then, I like before grad school, I went to take the test, and I think like I like went out that the night before.
So I had a different approach to the GRE because I graduated from Florida State with a psychology degree. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. So my strategy was I'm going to spend my entire senior year studying for the GRE to get the highest score possibly get, and then go to grad school and just buy myself more time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So that's that was good, though. Yeah. Like, that's a good strategy. Like, I just remember, I mean, I think it ended up being okay, but it wasn't like great. And then it, in the end, it didn't really matter. But I just remember how much I hated studying for it and like the dread that came with having to relearn that stuff.
Yes. I remember in high school, I had to do like a specific SAT program, like studying course, because I'm just not good at testing.
Too. I hate and testing.
Same. And so the GRE, it was like the same thing. I took this, I think it was Princeton Review. And so they don't really teach you the information for you to know it. They teach you strategies on how to pass it. So they're like, they're like, if you see this question, this is what you're going to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I've been basically cutting corners my entire life, which brings us to this episode. Welcome, everybody, to Matrix Assassins. Thank you so much for tuning in. We just wrapped up an incredible episode with Robin McKay. We talk all things imposter syndrome. We talk about the corporate culture. We talk about being awake in the corporate culture, how to exit the corporate culture. Nicole, what did you think about the episode?
It was a lot of fun to have the conversation, and it was nice to be able to be in a space where we could talk about all the things that get you canceled in the corporate culture. So it's nice to be amongst friends in that aspect. And it was really cool to talk about like the toxic work environment, what it's like dealing with narcissists in the work environment, and so much else. It was really cool.
We also learn about spiritual intelligence, which I found to be really fascinating, and how to implement positive psychology in our everyday lives. Obviously, we have a conspiratorial take on everything, so that always spices it up. But before we hit play, if you want to head over to www.matrixassassins.com, a great way to support us is you can buy some of our merch. Another way you can support us is like, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. We also have a Patreon channel. Head over there if you want to find the video format and support us on Matrix Assassins Patreon channel.
And before we press play, this episode is brought to you by Blue Shield. Blue Shield is a forerunner in EMF protection technology, and they offer a variety of different devices depending on the scale that you need. They have devices for a home and office that completely covers the entire area. They also have one for the car if you're traveling a lot, and also portables, which you can take with you on shorter trips to the store or like an overnight hotel stay. If you want more information on it, you can go to our story highlights in both of our Instagram accounts. And also you can head over to the sponsors tab at www.matrixassassins.com. And you'll find our code there, Matrix, and the link to Blue Shield. And then you can just enter Matrix at checkout for 10% off.
And with that said, Nicole, are you ready to exit the simulation?
I am.
Let's go.
We have temperatures right now in the 60s.
This bag right here.
You don't have to.
Welcome
to
Matrix Assassins.
Two real girls in a simulated world.
What did you think?
Well, I have a Berkey water filter too.
Oh, you do?
Okay, I was really nervous for a second. I was like, oh gosh, this is going to be a weird interview.
It's been over a year, so I don't even remember what was in that episode. I can only imagine.
So you talked about the Berkey, of course. You talked about predictive programming from some of the Netflix that I was like, oh, sisters, we've got some stuff to talk about today. Yeah, so, yeah. And I know that this podcast has evolved since then, but the heart and soul of it, I think, is really so evident in that first episode.
Thank you. That's so sweet to say.
How long have you had the Berkey?
You know what? I just got it recently after I watched this very disturbing video. Have you guys seen that?
Which one is it?
It's about what's in the water.
Oh, I've heard of it. Yeah. I haven't seen it though.
Yeah, yeah. So I watched that and I think truth has a frequency. So I'm always listening, just tuning into what the frequency is. And that to me was the moment that I was like, okay, I need to make a shift in how I'm drinking water. I was worried about, my husband is somebody who is much more pragmatic and grounded probably than you would describe me. I'm pragmatic and grounded, but in a different way. But I prayed actually. And I was like, okay, God, so I really want to get this Berkey and I don't want this to be a thing with my husband at all. Well, it turns out he received that video from somebody totally different. It wasn't me. He watched the whole thing. And at the end, I was like, I'm getting a water filtration system. And he said nothing. And now he likes it. So,
oh, I love that.
Love to hear it. We always recommend, did you get the extra filters?
I have two filters.
The fluoride filters.
Okay. Okay. So there are two extra filters. Are they the black ones or are they the?
The fluoride filters are the white ones, but you can always add them on. So the black ones, I believe, go in the top chamber and then the fluoride white ones go in the bottom chamber.
The bottom.
They connect.
And so those filter out the fluoride from the water. Okay. Yeah.
It like safe proofs your water experience. Yeah. Those extra filters. And then the Berkey shower filter is top notch. Either. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, obviously those are like additional things.
Yeah, yeah.
But I feel like the shower filter just really helps because it vapors, hot water vapors, so you're inhaling the fluoride.
Oh.
And it's, you know, our skin is our biggest organ, so it like seeps in. So filtering the water too helps a lot.
I also notice, you'll notice over time, but I notice it a lot where I am, when I fill the top chamber with the tap water, I can smell the chlorine coming off of it. So now I've had it for so long that I can really tell the difference just going straight from tap to after I have it when it comes through the filter.
Isn't that so interesting? We just moved into a new house in December. It's got a pool that was chlorinated and completely on a different, like I said, my husband is very pragmatic, but and more, way more grounded than I am. He just decided to change it to salt water.
Oh, nice.
So, you know, just something as simple as that, that we just know, I just always know everything's working for my good, but that was pretty cool to see that shift as well. So.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like it's little incremental changes. It kind of causes a chain reaction sometimes because one thing just leads into the next.
Welcome to another episode of Matrix Assassins. Robin has a PhD in counseling psychology from the University of Kansas, where she studied diverse concepts ranging from spiritual intelligence and personal development to positive psychology and creativity. Her distinct range of tools that span from the spiritual to the scientific serves as the baseline to her unique approach to transformational leadership and innovation. Thank you so much for stepping into the game with us this evening. We're so happy to have you on Matrix Assassins.
I am so happy to be here. I've got chills.
That's exciting. So, one of the things I noticed that I'm really interested in you explaining more about is what is spiritual intelligence? I feel like I've come across the term before, but I don't remember exactly what it's all about.
And there are different definitions of it too, for sure. So the one that I like to use is one that my graduate school mentor developed years ago. It was when I was in grad school, so it would have been 20 years ago. Spiritual intelligence to me has two major aspects. One is your capacity to alter your consciousness in the service of yourself or another person. So this comes out of the work the early work researchers were doing on how Indigenous cultures create transformation for their, I'm using air quotes here, but for their patients, for their community members. So how do the medicine men and women create transformation? Well, they alter consciousness through sweat lodges, right? Through elevating the temperature in a sweat lodge creates the conditions for a person's consciousness to be altered. But it's not just that, it's what you do with that as well. So there's a pliability of consciousness that's a piece of it. And the other one I've added in my work in the last 20 years, what I've come to realize is that spiritually intelligent leaders use, I'm going to say, energetic technology tools. Like, you can think of anything from tarot and oracle cards to rune stones to anything of that nature that you would use to deepen your understanding or knowing about what's going on in the world. But we use those tools to bring about real world transformation. So those are the two elements: altering consciousness and then using energetic tools and technologies in order to bring about transformation in the real world.
That's fascinating. I was curious, as far as spiritual intelligence, what are the correlations between spiritual intelligence and emotional intelligence? Do they intertwine? How does that?
It all goes back to, there are five different personality factors that we all have to varying degrees across cultures and around the world. These big five personality factors you might be familiar with if you studied psychology have been researched, I don't know, let's say for 70 years at this point, maybe even longer than that. But there's one factor of personality that is consistent with what I'm seeing with emotionally intelligent people and also spiritually intelligent people. And that's, how open are you to new experiences? So openness to experiences is the hallmark of spiritual intelligence, emotional intelligence, anything that is kind of outside that rational way of thinking about the world. There's a curiosity, there's the capacity and need, deep-seated need to challenge the status quo. There's a love of learning, a desire to keep learning more and more and more. There's one facet of that openness factor that I think is really interesting with regard to spiritual intelligence, and that's the imagination. That it's actually called fantasy on the assessment. But people who score high on imagination or high on fantasy have the capacity to see beyond the five, you know, beyond the, I was going to say the five senses, but beyond the 3D, we'll say, and to imagine what's possible, to see around corners, to be able to kind of not just predict, but kind of tap into what's next, what's coming down the line. So that would be more along the lines of spiritual intelligence. And the one that is connected with emotional intelligence is another facet of openness that's called feelings. And it's, how sensitive or aware are you of your own emotions and of the emotions of other people? So those are kind of, in a nutshell, the things that I see within the relationship between emotional intelligence and spiritual intelligence. They're not too different or distinct. And that's still an area that we're studying and kind of trying to parse out as we go along.
It seems as if people that carry these personality traits are most likely the ones that become awake in the 3D. Is that something that you agree
with? In fact, openness of all of the factors of personality, openness is the most highly heritable. So you get it from your family. And the way that my colleagues and I describe people who are open is that you're born with it. You're either born with your eyes wide open or you're asleep. And of course, there are some varying degrees, but it is pretty binary for the most part that we're just seeing. You've probably seen a little kid. You probably were little kids. I know I certainly was. That when they open their eyes, when they're little tiny kids and you look in there and you're like, there's somebody in there. Like, you may not be able to talk yet, but I see that there's somebody in there. That's that kind of, for me, that marker for when we're even small children, I can tell if somebody's going to be awake or not. We always have a choice, I think, to go back to sleep. But for the most part, the ones who are awake are born that way. We live in a culture, we live in this place where we are completely encouraged and medicated and, you know, we were just talking about fluoride in the water, all these things that create the conditions for our consciousness to kind of go back to sleep. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, all the way go back to sleep.
Yeah, that's interesting that you can inherit being awake.
Open.
Being open.
Being open.
Okay, that's true. Because I feel like there's so many people out there, including myself, that would say that maybe our parents aren't, they don't agree with what we think. They might even think that we're literally insane.
Yeah, they, so this is interesting. I want to just, can I just rip on that for a second?
Yeah,
that's so important. When you look at your parents, I'm going to guess there's quite a great likelihood that, and I wouldn't know unless I looked at your, it's called the NEO 5-Factor Personality Assessment. If I had your data, I'd be able to tell you for sure. But if you are open and if you have kind of a sixth sense, I call it the spidey sense, but if you have some kind of intuition, the likelihood that one of your parents had that is quite great. What earlier generations have done with openness, with intuition, and even with creativity is put it on the shelf because it was undervalued, underutilized, and underappreciated by the culture. So for the millennials and beyond, Gen X a little bit, that's my generation, but for the millennials and beyond in particular, we're just living in a different world right now where it's becoming more and more okay to be intuitive. It's becoming more and more okay to be awake. In fact, that's what's actually necessary here. So for our parents' generations, my mom is very intuitive and so is my dad, but they express it in different ways. And they're much more, I think, probably for sure subtle about it than I am. Certainly, I was on a podcast recently called Bitches, Bitches, and Dead People. Oh, my mom, she was like, oh, what did you just do? Yeah. It was a great podcast though. So
my mom is extremely intuitive and like really creative, almost psychic in a sense. And one thing that I thank goodness that she did when I was younger was she always tried to foster my imagination as much as possible. And I feel like when we're talking about the next generation, so Generation Z, the more that they're just in front of screens all day, they're not, it's almost like automated daydreaming because they're not able to foster that type of imagination that I feel like we as a generation, millennials, have been able to foster because we were that in between before screens and the internet took off. And I feel like maybe we're like that last generation to really kind of hold what it was like to have imaginations.
So smart that you're saying that. It reminds me of that. What was that movie? It was recently. It was where global warming and the meteor was coming to the Earth. Leonardo DiCaprio was in it.
Looking Up, Always Up.
It's
coming to me.
Yeah, with that Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in that. I couldn't watch the whole thing. I was just like, oof, that was just a lot. But there's a scene in it where the iPhone, let's say 19, whatever that version is, has a connection with the person's emotions. Oh, she's feeling sad. Let's show her a video of kitties playing. Like there's such a manipulation in our emotions and our psychology from the screens that we're using every single day. And to your point, the Gen Zs are really, I mean, my goodness, I worry about them. And I also know that we've got a lot of conscious people who are raising them, who are saying something different. They're wanting something different from their kids than what we're seeing in the mainstream for sure. So
it always saddens me when I see kids and they have their iPads and they're holding it around. And it's like, I couldn't imagine my brain at being that young, just always being on a screen and what that's doing to your dopamine levels. And I also I don't know which podcast it was, but I listened to this other podcast where they talked about most kids that have these screens and iPods are all going to have like myopic degeneration and all these types of like eye problems. So it's not only mental, but it's like all the physical ailments that are going to occur for this generation, which is kind of sad.
One other thing I've come across a couple times now too, going back to kids and also with learning and school, they're starting to use AI to analyze their personality characteristics and to try to foster them in certain directions, I guess, educationally or skills wise. So I'm kind of interested to see how that's all going to pan out, because I just wonder, like we were just talking about, how much of that is going to be manipulated versus actually like fostering their innate abilities. It almost seems like it could be used to put people in a certain direction or career path that's best for what society thinks they should be doing versus what they would maybe choose on their own without that assisted technology.
When I was a kid in the 80s, I grew up in the Cold War, and the worst thing on the planet was the Soviet Union. I mean, forget it. Like, we were all scared of nuclear war. That's how I grew up. And I remember hearing about the communist way of mapping kids into their fields, which reminds me a whole lot of what you're talking about here, is that to override somebody's individual and unique gifts, talents, and abilities for the good of something greater than themselves, which sounds like a good thing, but it's actually can be something pretty devilish as well. I'll use that word. I don't know what else to use.
Or dystopian or something.
Yeah, well, there's a word for you.
So let's backtrack a little bit. For our listeners, can you just give us a little bit about yourself, what you're currently working on, what has been interesting you currently?
Sure, of course. So where do I start there? My background, you did a beautiful job of describing. I have a PhD in counseling psychology. I've worked in the corporate space for... Even as I was getting my PhD, I was actually working in the pharmaceutical industry as a medical writer. So here's what's interested me in the past couple of years. I've always been interested in working with people who are intuitive, who are spiritually intelligent. Not everybody even knows what spiritual intelligence is, so I don't talk a lot about that, especially in the corporate space. But where I do speak is to emotional intelligence. I was an emotionally intelligent person living in a corporate world for a long time. I burned out. I worked in a biosafety level 3 laboratory early in my career as well. So I was working with really bad microorganisms, and I got depressed and I got anxious, and I had to take some vaccinations for some deadly organisms that I was working with at the time. So there was all of that going on for me as well. So I was down in the weeds. So I understand that. And now I'm on the other side and being able to mentor, advise, and coach emotionally intelligent leaders in the fields of tech and healthcare, medicine, and fintech in particular. They're my people, just because I'm one of those people too. I've just gotten on the other side of it. So you were asking about, I think maybe before we started recording, about how I'm working in the corporate space. I want to share this with you. And this is, I actually have a newsletter on LinkedIn that I just published my closing remarks on for this 4-month period of time. I was embedded with some of my colleagues with Intel Corp. And I was hired by one of the female executives to come in and work with a group of emotionally intelligent leaders. And I had to talk at one point about, I talked about breaking the busyness cycle. I talk about a lot about changing your relationship with time, with work, and with money. And I was thinking about, like, how do I talk about this? How do I talk about what I know about without talking about what I know about? And I'm like, well, I can't really do that. But the good thing is, do you know what I mean? Like, how do I?
Oh, 100%.
Absolutely.
Story of my life.
The cool thing is with tech people is that they love sci-fi as much as I love sci-fi. So I talked about jumping timelines, and I talked, and they just went with me on it. They just thought that that was such a great way of conceptualizing a difference in how I'm working, how I'm living. If I'm on this timeline here, whatever timeline this is, I called it the and better timeline. We can call it 5D or whatever in our world. But in the corporate space, especially the engineers, the tech people, the really brainy people who are very grounded in science, they're willing to have those conversations, and they find it fascinates them and it activates their imagination. So that's where I work in the corporate space, is just, I'm still helping them shift timelines, but I'm talking about it in a way that makes sense for their worldview and for where they're coming from right now. And I also, by the way, spent a whole lot of time with the women in those fields as well, because there continues to be such a challenge for women and for people who belong to groups that are underrepresented, especially in leadership in those fields. That's a lot of the work that I'm doing as well in terms of empowerment and leadership and just helping them understand the matrix so that they can advance and change things from the inside.
What are some of the top 3 most common issues within those environments that you come across? And then what are some of the things that you tend to work on with them to try to improve or to help shift their timeline in the corporate space?
So one is burnout, 100%. Everybody's burned out. The other is, I call it an existential conundrum, but it can actually be like, I kind of tongue in cheek with that, but it actually can be existential grief, existential anxiety, existential depression, especially at the beginning when everybody was sent home in, you know, Q1 of 2020. The people who I was working most closely with, the emotionally intelligent leaders who were in those particular spaces, would say, why am I even doing this? This doesn't even make sense to me why I'm doing this. The other thing that they would say is, I wish somebody would just tell me what to do. And I would have to say, I'm sorry to tell you this, but nobody's coming. You're it. You have to decide. And then making their decisions, the right decisions, as they're literally like choosing and moving to make sure that they have everything in place in order to do their jobs, but in order to also ensure that their people are able to do their jobs as well. So burnout for sure, the existential crisis is a piece of the puzzle as well. And then that kind of goes hand in hand with that is the big question of what's next and is this all there is? Mm-hmm. So I do
that
a lot of-
so big for me.
Really?
Oh yeah. My gosh.
How did that show up for you?
It showed up for me just feeling really depressed in my role and what I was doing. I also don't ethically agree with what I was doing. But yeah, it would show up for feeling like I wasn't, this is not what I was born to do. And this is not natural for me. And I'm trying to put a square peg in a round hole and trying to force myself to fit in. I would always call myself a corporate misfit. And I felt really left out and, yeah, existential dread.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say you're not alone in that, but it can be a very, very lonely position.
The way it manifested for me, I'm in a place right now with my job where I'm okay with where it is. It's not what I want to do forever, but it's not, you know, I feel that it's okay at this point, I guess, in time. But before I got to this point, I did have some, I don't know if it would be categorized as existential dread, but I used to think about like the 8-hour workday and how it just doesn't seem like it's really conducive to productivity and how it feels like, you know, it would be nice to have a little bit more flexibility in a sense and not have to be constrained within those 8 hours. And then also thinking about how with work, you're, you know, it's a financial transaction. And I almost see it as like a parentification in a sense, like you're going from, so when in childhood, you're under your parents, you're financially dependent upon them. There's a lot of strings that can be attached depending on that relationship. And then when you move into the work or the corporate environment, it's almost like it's a transfer in a sense, depending.
It's like another toxic relationship.
Right. Or it can be, I mean, it's all obviously like different relationships, but there's that dependency in a sense, like you're shifting your dependency to an employer. And I think working through that sometimes is difficult too. So I always wonder if that's something that kind of comes up in your line of work as well.
It is. It is. In fact, I love, there's a, I don't know who does this on Insta. Somebody does these reels on the millennial hotline for corporate. Like, oh, wow. The question is, my boss mad at me? And then they analyze the text messages. Yeah. Okay, was there an exclamation point after okay, or was it just okay? Like all of these nuances.
That's hilarious.
It's like, but the funny thing is, it's actually true. I noticed I had to reschedule with one of my execs in corporate. And listen, I'm still extracting myself from the corporate space, and I'm adjacent to it now, but I still go back into it. And I had to reschedule with one of my execs we had a conflict, and I texted her and said, need to reschedule. She responds with okay. And I'm like, oh shit, is it really okay? Or is it like not okay? Or what does that okay mean? There's so many subtleties, especially when you're intuitive, that you can read into. Mm-hmm. There are some people with emails and with text messages who will say, oh, you can't read into any of that. you can't pick up on the subtleties. Well, I would beg to differ. Mm-hmm. I think that there are those of us, regardless of generation, who are more sensitive to the written word and to the frequencies through which those written words come. So what we have to do, though, is to be very discerning about how we're interpreting the words, the language, the messages that we're receiving, and not just take them at face value or based on assumptions on, to your point, the parentification in the workplace as well. In fact, it reminds me, that's one of the things I talk about in jumping those timelines from, I have a triad that I've set up. This is the old timeline. See if this lands for you. Mm-hmm. If we have a triangle, we have an employee, we have a boss, and we have tasks, projects, what are some, like those kinds of things. So there's our triad. Well, the problem with that is that, just to your point, when you're an employee and you're looking to your boss to tell you what to do, to affirm that you're doing things right, to worry about if you're going to get in trouble or not, all of those things, it's a pretty toxic triad. Mm-hmm. And you've got this thing that you have to do, which is the task, the assignment, the whatever. It creates this, well, let me just ask you, when I say that, what occurs to you in terms of how it feels?
For me, it manifests as I get anxiety from it. Like I feel very constrained, and it's kind of like, I don't like the power structure of it. Like I just think that it almost needs to be a little bit more evened out, or there needs to be a little bit more control over the tasks or over the working relationships amongst team members, in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally, exact same thing. Just constrained.
Yeah. Constrained, worried, afraid. It's all of that old energy from, we'll say, circa 2019 and before that, definitely 2020. Where we're headed, and what I talk a lot about, is let's collapse that. Let's collapse that triangle and let's find something else to work in. And I forget what his name is, but there's some, I wish I could remember. There's a transformational coach who has created this new triad, and it's the coach, creator, challenger triad. So now, instead of an employee, you can be a creator. And instead of a boss, I can be a coach. And instead of a task or a project, now I have a challenge. Oh, and I, you like can that. See how, isn't that lovely? How that can just shift, and it just opens things up. That's a lot of, I'm going to say it's a lot of work, but it's literally just a jump in perspective. And you can start that jump. Our listeners can start that jump just by deciding, rather than showing up as an employee, I'm going to show up, even though I am, I'm going to show up as a creator. What can I contribute today? What do I need to master today? How can I make a difference today? Those are all questions that we're asking anyway. So from the creator perspective, suddenly we have this opening up of what's possible in the workplace, in the world.
I really like that. And even like that, so it's like a complete reframing of those different roles, which I think makes a huge impact. And it's just, it made me think about the supervisory role for some reason, because at least in my experience, I find that I don't really interact with them in like a coaching type manner. It's more, I just try to do as much as possible so that I don't have to interact with them at all. So I feel like if I'm on top of everything, if I can predict like five steps ahead, if I can like do all the things that I need to do to not have to like hear anything from them, that's ideal for me. But then thinking of it as like a coaching relationship, I can see how it can be more beneficial, because then you can actually get maybe like constructive feedback or some type of benefit from the relationship, instead of being so siloed, in a sense.
Yes, for sure. I always had the advantage. I want to say I got lucky, and I don't think it's actually luck. I think that for whatever reason, I have always had really good bosses when I worked in the corporate space, and really good leadership when I worked in the corporate space. I brought my own baggage to those relationships, of course, but they were always people in my life who I continue to look up to admire, to look to for guidance or wisdom or something like that, coaching in some cases. And that just, I don't know how or why that happened for me. It's just something that happened in my experience. And it doesn't happen for everybody. But I think that the more you can start thinking of yourselves as, I'm a creator, what can I contribute? rather than, here's the other thing that comes up a lot that people aren't aware of until I say it. So check in with yourselves on this one too. There's a lot of over responsibility for outcomes. Yeah. Like, I'm fully and wholly responsible for this thing. And if I don't make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed and I'm five steps ahead, then I'm to blame that it's failed. So when you have that, it actually contributes to burnout for sure. When you shift from being thinking that you're the source or thinking that you're wholly and fully responsible to asking that question of how can I contribute, that's a game changer as well. Because now I'm not wholly and fully responsible. It's a creative process that I'm going to contribute my very best. I'm going to come in with my gifts, my talents, my abilities, my insights, my wisdom, and offer that contribution. But it's not just me who's responsible for the whole. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, definitely.
So that's a lot what I talk about with my corporate execs and even the individual contributors who find their way to me as well. Those are the conversations that I have with them, because I think the more that we make these shifts on an individual level, then you're awake to it. And then you can decide, is this even a place that's possible for me? It could be that you're in a work environment where you're never going to find a coach because they just don't exist there.
I like how you said too, previously you were talking about tuning into the frequency of like before 2019, before 2020, because I feel like, and let me know if you agree with this, but I just feel like there was just such a massive perceptual shift when it came to the corporate world, because a lot of people could now work from home. There was more flexibility. I feel like now going into an office job and doing a 9-to-5 and literally staying there until 5 o'clock is archaic at this point. And I'm not saying that in like a like if there's anybody that's listening that still does that, that's not about you. It's just like the system is old.
It is old. And I'm at the place where, you know, people have been talking for a while now about collapsing and dismantling the systems and structures. And I'm like, let's just abandon them and create something new. Let's jump timelines and create something new, because there are people who are always going to press for the current system because they benefit from it. The ones who don't benefit from it are the ones who are going to be asking for something different. The ones who want to keep it are the ones who benefit from it and have benefited from it for a long time. So having said that, then yes, when I think that there's been a really big shift, and now there's another one as people are going back into the office and some resistance to that and some anxiety. I created this whole life for myself and now you want me to go back into the office 3 days a week? Are you kidding me? Every organization is handling it differently. There are some who are saying, we want ultimate flexibility for our people. What does that look like? And they're really taking, in my mind, a very innovative approach to the return to the office. There are some who love to go. I was talking to somebody who is at one of the organizations I work with, and she's like, I got to go to have salad at the salad bar with my friend after 2 years. I was so excited to see her. There's somebody else who was really excited to wear her badge again, although I have no idea why that is. I never liked wearing badges. I thought that was always so weird. But nonetheless, everybody's going to have a different perspective of what it means to go back into the office. And organizations are handling that different. And it's actually, interestingly, there's, as you know, been this big push for diversity, inclusion, and belonging and equity. And yet there are some of these organizations who are saying, for new hires, for example, we're not hiring you if you can't move. Really? If you can't relocate to XYZ city from XYZ city, we can't hire you. Are you kidding me? But who benefits from that?
What's up, everybody? Just wanted to quickly interrupt the show to let you know about our new sponsor, Coffee Conspiracy Co. Exit the corporate coffee matrix and tumble down the rabbit hole with Coffee Conspiracy. Founded in 2020, their mission is to expose the best coffee in the industry while throwing a red pill or two in along the way.
Ethically sourced, fresh, roasted, single origin coffee delivered straight to your door. Join our not-so-secret society and become a co-conspirator today. You can use coupon code MATRIX15 for 15% off your first order. Coffee Conspiracy, exposing the best coffee.
Okay, back to the show. What are your thoughts on woke corporate culture? Knowing what you know, what are your true thoughts?
Well, you just went right for it, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, woke corporate culture. I think that when we're looking at the woke left, there's an unconscious wounded outpouring that's happening. And there is a justification based on that unconscious woundedness that's coming forward. I think it's actually exclusionary. I think that it is something that it's one of the reasons I say we can't just dismantle, we can't burn stuff down, we just have to abandon it. And I think it's my experience with it that there's a lot of judgment and there's a lot of walking on eggshells that happens. Do I have my pronouns on LinkedIn or not? I have chosen to do that. As a psychologist, I do have some responsibilities to, I believe I have some responsibilities to that, but there's judgment if you don't. There are assumptions that people make about you if you don't. So I don't know actually if, are we getting at what I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a hard question. So Does that make sense?
But do you feel that you're putting your pronouns on there to like kind of appease that side in a way?
You know what? I love the people. I love the people. And I want people who are transgendered. I want people who are feeling different, feeling left out to feel included. And if that's one thing that I can do, I don't mind to do that. If I minded to do it, I wouldn't have done it. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah.
There are some people, I have Christian friends who are like, oh no, there's only two genders and I do not have to do that. And they don't, that's their choice. For me, I have this, I'm kind of like Switzerland in some ways. I was trained as a psychologist and one of my mentors in psychology said this to me one time. She said, she's describing her own practice. And she said, I sat with in one session, a Wiccan priestess. And in the very next session, I sat with a fundamental Christian white male. And they both told me at the end of their sessions that they felt understood. And I thought, what for me, that inspired me because I, more than anything else, I want people to feel that I understand or that it gives them space to be able to explore and to answer their own questions rather than me overlaying any of my agendas onto them. So as far as the pronouns go, I don't have whatever.
Definitely.
It's fine. Although I do I'm a writer. And I'm like, the they thing, I'm like, oof, I don't know if I can do that just grammatically. I kind of, but I understand it. I just I'm grammar queen. So I want people to use your and your properly and two properly. So
part of me feels that, I mean, I completely understand that, especially being a psychologist and needing to be aware of like the most relevant cultural phenomenons and trends and understanding, you know, multiculturalism, diversity, and being able to relate, you know, to all different types of people. But as far as, you know, like the general public and just, I guess, just to this point about the, you know, putting the pronouns into like a profile or on like a resume or into LinkedIn, I just always think about it as, is that really, I mean, I guess it's about inclusivity, but if you think about it, what if you're in a work environment where that doesn't even apply? So is it more of a virtue signal to make it seem like you're more, I don't know. I don't even know how to describe, like, if like you're more aware of like the current trend of where the culture is, or I don't know. Cause I almost see it as like percentages, like what percentage of the population is in that category compared to the rest. And I know that's growing. I know that it's actually getting a lot bigger than it was, but I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense, like getting to the aspect of like, what percentage are we trying to include,
include and or appease.
Yeah.
So I was reflecting, I said that I had listened to your very first podcast and it was like over a year ago, I think, that you published it. So I don't know when you recorded it, but you had some, I think that you had mentioned that there was a time when you were putting the black square on.
Oh yeah. Instagram. For
BLM. Yeah. That would, mm-hmm. that'd be me.
Yeah.
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 And then, so from an energetic and spiritual perspective, when I look at things like that, we didn't know what we didn't know. And right. when you, it's credited with Maya Angelou, maybe she said it, maybe she didn't, but when you, or Oprah, when you know better, you do better. Mm-hmm. So regardless of who said that, I think that that's important. And when you are really awake to what's going on, you have to be mindful. I made to go back to the pronouns. I made a conscious choice to do so because I'm working in the corporate mm-hmm. space, because that is important to some of the people who I work with. And I want to do them that honor. Mm-hmm. But however, to your point about virtue signaling, I think that that is something that we have to always be mindful and aware of, like the black squares. Am I virtue signaling?
I did that to make myself look better. 100%. Like I take full accountability for that. But again, like you don't know what you don't know. Not saying everybody that posted the black square, that was their intention, but that was surely mine.
Well, I think that, and there's so much, if we want to get into kind of the more woo aspects of that, there's so much spell casting been happening in social media and, black magic and all kinds of really anti-human agendas mm-hmm. in social media that we also have to be, I have to pay attention to that as well. I have a couple of nieces who are Gen Z and, they go sideways with me sometimes about some of the things that I think. But they actually, this is funny. I was up visiting them in August of 2020. They live in South Dakota and I live in Arizona. So I had flown up to see them and they were astounded that this is a throwback because I've changed my mind since then, but and we can talk about this in a minute, who I was choosing to vote for in the elections mm-hmm. and that I also didn't eat meat. Like they couldn't resolve those two things. They were too different.
That is hilarious. So they thought like one had to be mutually exclusive to mm-hmm. the other.
Like there's no way that she can be voting for this person, this candidate, and not eat meat. Yeah.
It's just so, it's so telling to so many other aspects. Like, you know, that's a great mm-hmm. capture of it, but I feel like that could be applied across so many different preferences mm-hmm. or personal decisions and choices.
Well, that's the easy way route it's easy route to dichotomize, mm-hmm. to make everything black and white, either or. And that I think, to go back to your question about the woke and corporate, is that there's such a dichotomization of it. It's either or, black and white. In psychology, we know all kinds of variation in shade and degree of color and intensity, right? That we have to account for. If we don't, we're not binary. We are, as humans, we are not binary. In fact, I would say even the people who claim to be woke would say we're not binary. And yet the trick that they use, the mind trick that they use, is to make everything binary. Right. If you're not for us, you're against mm-hmm. us.
And I just feel sometimes that these different examples are almost patronizing in a sense. It's kind of like just because, pandering. Yeah, like just because you choose not to put that in your profile or wherever doesn't mean that you don't support people of different backgrounds or, you know, different decisions, genders. It's just that, why does there need to be a need for it? I just see it so much as a virtue signal that I think it should be more about how you treat people on an individual level versus what you show to the exterior world to make somebody think that you're a certain way. I feel like your action should speak louder than just putting something there, you know, not that there's anything wrong with putting it there, but I guess that's my personal feeling on it, is that we shouldn't have to like advertise what our leaning is. I think it should be more about what our relationships reflect and what our interactions show.
You're so smart to say that. Yeah, no, you're so smart to say that. In fact, I was reflecting.
She's
so smart.
We're also smart.
Well, you know, I wrote a book called Smart Girls in the 21st century. So yeah, so that was, it came out a long time ago, but well, it came out in the 21st century, it came out a year ago. But yeah, that's what, you know, I can identify gifted and talented pretty easily. But I think that as I'm listening to this part of the conversation, I'm thinking, I need to go back and revisit that for myself, because at the time, that was the most important thing. I probably changed that as soon as it was available on LinkedIn. And I'm like, now, is it necessary today? Is it necessary for today, for right now, for what's going on in my life, in my perspective, how I've shifted since 2020, all the red pills I've taken since 2020, like all the things, is it actually relevant and necessary for me to do so today? And maybe it is, and maybe it isn't, but it's worthy, to your point, of going back and asking, how can I get even more in alignment with what I value, with what I hold precious and true, and stop any virtue signaling, because that's not where we want to go anyway.
Yeah, because it seems like these trends are so tied to like the cultural impetus at the moment. And it's almost like, you know, we're talking about the BLM squares. Well, that fad is like completely gone now. Nobody still has like a black tile. You know, it didn't like pan out for that long. So I almost see it as like it's serving some type of purpose in the moment. And I don't see it as really benefiting the person it's supposed to as much as it's trying to benefit more of like an agenda or a political leaning.
For sure.
What I was going to say previously was the act of what you just did, I think, is just so like that it happens on the podcast that I wish more people could do, is like the big trait, like being open to going back and reevaluating is like, and it could still ring true and it could not. And I think like that is just so, it's just so profound and I love it. So much.
So important, isn't it, to be able to just look at something with fresh eyes, even going back to marketing materials or something that you've put out into the world, you know, 3 years ago or 5 years ago, and say, do I still stand by this? And it could be that you don't, and that's okay. We grow, we develop, we evolve, we learn. That's our gift as humans, is that we have the capacity for expansive learning. And if we're not growing and shifting how we're showing up in the world, then what are we doing? We're just becoming automatons.
I think so too. And it seems like the consequences are just so much more severe now because of the cancel culture. And it's like, if you get pegged in a certain category, it can have dire consequences. You know, people lose jobs over it. You know, it can wreck a relationship. There's just so many ramifications now to certain aspects of what we're talking about that also makes it seem like it takes away the authenticity of the point of whatever the moment situation is, I guess. It's like, you know, do you want a bunch of people broadcasting that they feel a certain way just to appease the public or to like appease the perception of others? Or do you want them to be genuinely accepting and okay and kind to, you know, to different opinions, genders, you know, diversity, that type of thing. It just doesn't feel genuine. It just feels like a bandwagon and like a conformity over something else, you know, that sort of.
But isn't that, I mean, that's what the Matrix wants anyway. Like,
yeah, it is.
So whether it's the BLM black square, but even something much more embedded, which is Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I had to think about this year. Okay.
Oh no. It's sad.
Happy birthing woman day.
Right? Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, hell no.
Birthing person?
No.
Okay.
But I had to really think about, am I posting something? And then, so I'm not a mom. I got my PhD and wrote a book. And by that time I was like, I think my eggs are too old. And, but I have a dog. Cooper is my golden doodle. And he's like, I'm a dog mom. I know it's so basic.
I am too. I have two.
I saw one.
I wish Nicole Happy Mother's Day.
Yeah, for me.
for dogs. Wish,
so I posted Happy Mother's Day even to the cross. I called it the cross species moms, like the dog moms. Yeah. And so that was my contribution. And I posted a nice picture of me and my mom for my mom. But I was really like, this year I was like, okay, why am I doing that? But any celebrity deaths now, I don't post on that. No, it feels disingenuous. And I also know that most of them are, you know, puppets anyway. So
what about when one of your friends or somebody you know passes away?
On social media?
Mm-hmm.
So I had somebody who I grew up with, our families grew up together, and he was married to one of my childhood friends. He's 49 and he just died. I didn't post on social media. I did go to the website, the obituary website, and just wrote a brief note to my friend to say sorry I was for her loss. But I didn't. I mean, it's too personal and it's too private for me to. I think it would depend, though. What do you think? Would you do it for if one of your friends died?
This is hard. So I always have to go back to, like, what am I doing it for? I have not. I find it fascinating when I do see people posting about, like, their friends or somebody that they knew. And I understand that it can be a way to express grief, which is really important. I'm, like, so pro, like, expressing any type of repressed emotions, however you want to do it. But I do find that it's a phenomenon that never occurred before in the history, you know, of mankind to like do that. So that's just, I just find it different and just wanted to know your personal like opinion.
I just think we have to just be so conscious and conscientious about why we're doing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the greatest gifts we can give ourselves as we extract from the matrix is to come online, get off of autopilot. Mm-hmm. Stop doing stuff just because everyone else is doing it. Especially if you feel social pressure to do something, don't do it.
Absolutely. Cause I just think about the pressures, you know, that we're all dealing with and how, you know, the human desire to belong and to conform is so strong. So I just feel that it's so easy to manipulate that primal need that we all have. And it just shows how powerful it is and how much it's just happening in different forms so much more than I think we ever had to deal with before. It just seems like it's like a constant thing now.
Well, it's a manipulation of human consciousness. Mm-hmm. When we're looking at mainstream manipulation of human consciousness, what you two are doing with this podcast is gathering people who also want to belong somewhere. Mm-hmm. Being a breath of fresh air, being a contribution to those of us who have a deeper or a different understanding of what's going on in the world and why things are happening the way they are. And that gathering space that you've created here and that others like us have created gives an opportunity for us to step into that new timeline that we've been talking about, that timeline where we are creating the, whatever you want to call it, the new earth or the new timeline in terms of what's possible for humanity with freedom, with love and acceptance and truth, rather than the manipulations that are going on ongoingly.
Yeah. And I think without the internet, it would have been so much more difficult to actually find as many who are kind of on that same wavelength, because at least in my personal life and the lives of others that kind of are, you know, in the same predicament, it's really difficult to come across that. I know some people might not know anyone. Some people might only know one or two people in their personal life, but it's just, it can be, I found that it seems like it's more rare than it is otherwise.
I think we're still so cautious about talking about what we're talking about in the public sphere. Yeah. And really kind of still speaking in code. I have a couple of neighbors in this neighborhood I just moved into who, you know, you kind of tiptoe around and you kind of feel into where are you at with this and where are you at with that, and are always glad to know that somebody sees things in a similar way than you do, that you do, because we do have this human desire for connection and to be understood, and to feel like you're a part of something that is bigger than you. But we want it to be real. We don't want it to be manufactured by some, you know, machine or some small group of beings who are, you know, basically running a science project. At least I don't.
Right. No, definitely not.
What are some of the psychology strategies that maybe we can talk about that our listeners and us, we can all implement to up-level and optimize our day-to-day lives?
What we're living in right now is like a stress bowl, and we're bumping up against all kinds of realizations that are, at least for me, I've had my own degree of existential crisis. There have been times where I can't even look in the night sky because I'm like, oh, I don't even know like, what I'm looking. What
oh is my that? Gosh, is I had one of real? Those today. That is so Did funny you mention that.
Really?
Because I came across an article where they were talking about some new discovery within the Milky Way galaxy. And this never, I mean, I've always been so interested in astrophysics and astronomy, but for some reason today I had that existential dread feeling about, I guess it's, they're trying to capture imaging of the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And I don't know why, I was just thinking of the scale of that and the magnitude and it just hit me in a different way than usual. So I feel like I completely yeah. relate to that.
Yeah. I was looking at this. So in Phoenix, I live in the desert and we don't have a lot of light. So we've got pretty bright stars, but I was out there the other night walking Cooper and I was like, I don't even know if this is real. Mm-hmm. I think about all the stories that I learned when I was a kid and all the science that I learned. And I'm like, have I just been taught a bunch of fairy tales and fables? Is that what's going on here? And it really, so a lot of us, I think, whether it's to that degree or not, I don't mm-hmm. know for people, but there is this existential angst that we're experiencing collectively. So what I don't teach is how to survive in the current circumstances. I really don't. I'll talk about the Matrix and I'll talk about the Hunger Games because I think that that's a lot of what I'm living in right now too. Sometimes I wonder if it's a combination of those two. And the best ways, the strategies that I use with myself and with my clients as well is how can I lean into my strengths? How can I lean into my highest potential? What did I come here to master? More so than even what I came here to contribute. Because to be honest, I've had my publisher reached out to me recently. She's like, can you write another book? And I'm like, I don't know if I can. Because I don't know if what I'm going to write will even matter. And I don't mean this isn't a therapy session, but like that's the extent of what I think some of us are really asking, like, that's the existential nature of what we're experiencing right now. Does what I'm doing even matter? We know it does intellectually, but there's kind of that felt sense of, I'm not sure if it does. And I don't know if I want to put all my work and effort into this thing that may or may not matter in the future. So if you've had that experience, what I have found is a better question to ask is, what am I here to master that I haven't mastered yet? What are those persistent things that keep on kind of, you know, scratching at me saying, I really need to work on this? Not from a should perspective, but something that on a soul level, you actually came here to master, whether it's relationships or doing business or making money. Maybe it is writing a book. I don't know if that's something that you came here to master that you haven't done yet. Maybe that is a thing. But when we look at it from a place of what did I come here to master versus what can I give more of when I don't even know if what I'm giving matters? The mastery always matters because that's something that you have soul level control over, what you choose to master. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm sorry. If you want like psychological strategies, like stepwise recipes, like I'm not like, that's not.
Oh no.
We can just end this.
No. let's just leave now. But I think that those are the deeper questions, honoring your deep questions, stop gaslighting yourselves, because that's another thing that we are so good at doing. We have these psychic experiences or intuitive experiences, and then we gaslight ourselves and we say, I'm making it up in my head. No one else is thinking what I'm thinking. I must be going crazy. Like that stuff is, if we could eliminate that from our consciousness, the gaslighting ourselves, we don't need anybody else to do it for us. We're very good collectively at doing that for ourselves in the name of keeping ourselves safe, because we don't want anybody else to think we're crazy either. Being as much as you can, finding a way to find flow every single day. Flow is that consciousness state where you lose track of time, you become completely absorbed and engaged in the activity, and you're challenged by it. So it's not scrolling through social media. You can kill time during that. But when you literally like dive into time, like it's a deep well, and you are just in the moment doing the thing that you know that you're here put on this earth to do, Those are the things I think are good strategies for managing the stress, first of all, but also to leaping the timeline as well.
And I guess for those that are out there that feel stuck because they might not have found that yet, I guess.
Are you talking to me?
I know, right? To me too. I'm one of those out there.
You mean me?
For those of you.
Yeah. How do you advise people within the corporate world on what to do about that? I know a lot of times it can be maybe something in the back of your mind that you've always thought about exploring and just finally taking the step to do it. But for those who just don't even have the next step, is there something that people can kind of do to try to get closer to whatever that is?
So one of the things I talk a lot about is that energy of busyness. I'm so busy. I've got emails and I've got Slack messages and I've got all the things and it's so busy and everything is coming at me. And I talk about breaking the busyness cycle and we can talk about it intellectually. You know what you're supposed to do to break the busyness cycle. Step away from your screen every 50 minutes and, put your email to bed at a certain time and don't check it until the next day. You know all of those things, but we're programmed, and I'm using that word deliberately, to check. We're checkers. Mm-hmm. We have to check. And then we get that hit of dopamine every time we check and we see the little red dot on our social media or we see a new email in our inbox, whatever it is. And so that deeper work, the energetic work of it, is to clear out the energetic hooks, cords, even implants that are contributing to that busyness cycle. And once you do that, you can start to hear the voice of your own soul again. But when you're so caught in that sticky, icky web of busyness, it's very difficult. I would say that both of you know on a deep level what's next. Let me put it this way. When I talk to people about what's next for them, whether it's I want to find my next level position in the corporate space, or I want to make the leap into running my own business, or I want to go back to school, whatever it is, what I always say is, the poet Rumi, I think he was 13th century, he's Persian. He said, what you seek is seeking you. And when you operate from that perspective of what you seek is seeking you, that's universal law, meaning that it's not throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. It's more like the search for the golden egg. And for me, when I think about that saying, what you seek is seeking you, when I have something in mind for myself, whether it's the new Academy of Actualization that I'm starting, or a new corporate opportunity that has come up that I really want to make a contribution in that organization, when I think about what I seek is seeking me, I feel this relaxed sense in my being. My inner being just knows that that's true. And then that gives me confidence to pursue, even if I can't see it yet, I know that it's out there. Does that make sense? And is that helpful?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful. Hmm. Yeah. I don't know why, but while you were talking about that, the concept of imposter syndrome came up. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to talk about that because I'm sure it comes up a lot for you. And I know it's pretty common for a lot of people, but where do you think that comes from? And is it something that's pretty standard to most people, or is it something that maybe not as many people experience regularly?
Well, I think that smart girls in particular experience imposter syndrome. And I will talk about a couple of psychological strategies for that, because I think that's so important to take a look at. There were a couple of researchers that published an article in the Harvard Business Review back in February of 2021. I can't remember their names, but I remember the issue. And I remember the title of their article, which was Stop Telling Women That They Have the Imposter Syndrome. And the imposter syndrome, traditionally, my co-author and I wrote about this in our book, Smart Girls, is that inner sense that somebody's going to find out that I'm not as smart, I'm not as qualified, I'm not as capable as I've led them to believe. So that's one aspect of the imposter syndrome that I talk a lot to about, especially with high achieving young women as they're getting started in their careers. And even this, it follows us. Listen, the top execs who are female would be lying to you if they tell you that they don't have it, unless they've worked with me. I'm kidding. Mm-hmm. But it follows us. There are even moments where I'm like, wait a minute, like, really? Am I really? You want me to do this? So there is that kind of innate questioning of competence, of qualifications. And women are the ones who are most likely to not apply for a position unless they meet all of the requirements for the position. Men generally will apply if they've got like 50% of the requirements. Women, we think that we have to have all the requirements before we can apply for a position. When we're in college, boys will say, oh, I got a C in that class. That professor, I could not understand a word out of his mouth. He was so complex and so complicated. They externalize it, they blame other people. When girls, especially in STEM fields, get their first C even on a test, they think things like, maybe I'm not as smart as I thought I was. They even start to downgrade their aspirations as a result of that. So they'll say, well, I want to go to medical school, but I got a C on this organic chemistry test. So maybe I should just go to nursing school instead. And they'll say it exactly like that. So that's the imposter syndrome that I've talked about in the past. These authors that I referred to in the Harvard Business Review said, stop telling women they have the imposter syndrome, and here's why. They said that the imposter syndrome is part of the systems and structures that are in place in the corporate space. So if you're not, we're going to use all the language that they used in this article. If you're not cisgender, male, white, Christian, in other words, if you're not at the center of privilege and power, the systems and structures in the corporate space are set up to exclude you, to make you feel othered, to make you feel different. So I think that there's two things going on there, isn't there? There's one is the systems and structures. I know that a lot of the women, especially in the tech space who I work with, will say, I'm so tired of this bro culture. But that's the over and over, especially when we're looking at, you know, the high performance areas, I'm so sick of going to these conferences where they've got the rah-rah, you know, fist bumping, high-fiving dude on stage talking about, you know, go fight, win, and, you know, living your best life. Unrelatable. Here's a psychological strategy that can work if you're experiencing the imposter syndrome. Try this. Why don't you just assume that everyone else at the table is an imposter?
That they are?
That they are an imposter. Okay.
Just deflect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a fun way of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I actually, my co-author on Smart Girls, Barb, she just turned 70 this year. She's like old school, boomer, love her. She loves young people and she loves to talk about stuff like this. And she said when she is a distinguished professor at this point in her career. So she's like, kind of like the Supreme Court, like they can't be fired. She just gets to work until she decides not to anymore. But she said when she was younger, she would just go into meetings and rather than thinking that she was the imposter, she just assumed everyone else was. And I thought, oh, that's a good strategy. So just something to play around with. Like, what if everyone else is an imposter and I'm the one who actually belongs here? So that could be fun to play with.
I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. It's just like these different shifts.
Yeah.
Kind of like the shifts we were talking about earlier that just are really expansive and just kind of can change things so easily.
Yeah. And the other thing too, I would say, especially if for the younger women, there are a lot of precocious women who are from an age perspective, younger than their peers and younger, and sometimes even put in leadership positions, and they're younger than the people that report into them. So if that's you, one of the things that you can always think about with regard to imposter syndrome is that most likely you've had that experience from the time you're a little kid. Maybe you got accelerated in school, and so you're the youngest one in class or whatever it is. It has very little to do actually with age, but our culture, and we'll just call it since we're on the Matrix Assassins, the Matrix sets us up to think that I don't know enough because I'm younger.
Yeah, it's like a mask.
What do I know? True. I'm just too different from everybody else, or I don't belong to that generation. Well, how many of us can say that? I was a science girl. I was one of the only women until I wasn't. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, one thing I think it does really well and has for years is there is a lot of diversity within, at least gender diversity. There always has been. There's been women in leadership in pharma for a long, long time, and women rising as scientists and statisticians and so on within that realm. That's probably the one thing that they've done pretty well.
One thing that I heard about imposter syndrome is instead of saying that you're an imposter, just convince yourself that you're an apprentice.
And I like that kind of, too.
Yeah. Like just
how do you feel about that?
Who, me?
Yeah. How does that, in other words, I'm going to just play devil's advocate, because if you're a leader and you're younger and now I'm going to just convince myself I'm an apprentice rather than an imposter and I'm supposed to be a leader, like, I don't know how that really.
That's true. That's true.
I would challenge that.
Yeah. I actually, that's a very, very valid point. I think personally how it like relates to me is because I'm learning a new skill and it is kind of like an apprenticeship. So it's easy for me to kind of step into that. But I absolutely agree 100%. Like if I was a leader and I'm just trying to convince myself and I'm an apprentice, I could see how that is also playing into the whole imposter syndrome complex.
Yeah. I'm just learning still. I don't know. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Dying down. Like who, like your creative genius in a sense.
Oh, I have a good one for you.
Okay.
Two things. So one, do you ever deal with situations where people are, I guess, asked to be a leader when they don't have the title, the official title or the role?
Or the salary increase.
And I just find that interesting because I've dealt with that in my work before where for whatever reason, you know, like in consulting, sometimes like that slot isn't allotted in the budget on whatever contract. So until that happens, you kind of just have to, and then you could always justify it by saying like, oh, well, I could build the skills before the position gets there. And like, that's always how it's marketed. But I always felt kind of like it's not really, I mean, it's nice to grow in that way, but it's not the same without it, because it's like, you know, that whole thing within psychology, it's like, you know, the authority and the title really matters and it kind of fosters your behavior and the way others perceive you. It's like not having that almost makes it harder for you to actually fulfill that role because it's not official, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. And I have dealt with that a lot. I remember I got a call from one of my colleagues who works at a tech company here in the Valley. This was several years ago. I'm going to say like 2017. She calls and says, Robin, I just got promoted to VP. And I'm like, oh, congratulations. And she totally blew it up. She's like, I've been doing the job for a year. They finally upgraded my title. Mm-hmm. And she's in her 40s and she's very successful. But even at that level, there was that do the job and then we'll give you the title at some point. So then we have also this challenge of what would a mediocre white dude do?
He would leave probably and go find something else.
Or he would go to his boss and say, I can do this, but I'm going to need a promotion and a title change, right? Like those are the things if we could, I'm not saying think like a mediocre white dude, but there is some wisdom there, I think as well, that can be helpful just from a strategic perspective. Mm-hmm. And to your point, it is harder to not have a title and to be able to do the work that you're meant to do if you're being tapped to be a leader. I don't have an easy solution to that. I do know that it's a big problem. And I think that one of the challenges, especially for women who are, it's hard to be a leader and be so nice. Like I'm a good person but I'm honest and I'm straightforward. I'm not particularly agreeable. For people who are agreeable, who are just genuinely nice people and also leaders, it's really hard because you want to do a good job. You want to do the right thing. You want to say yes and help out. And that's how we get programmed from the time we're little girls is be helpful. You make sure to be helpful, right? So that gets programmed in early. And then you're confronted with something like, we want you to do this job. And they kind of build you up like, this is such an honor for you to be able to do this job. But I'm sorry, you're not going to get any extra pay and you don't get a title increase. It costs nothing to give a title increase, by the way. Nothing. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I've come across recently, and I always look at patterns, so it's not just one person, but there have been several people who have come to me recently, women in their mid to late 30s who have gotten tagged for leadership roles and then have stepped away from them and stepped back into individual contributor roles.
Very interesting, because that's actually something one of my former supervisors did. She also has her PhD. And is there, so what is that phenomenon about?
Well, my take on it is that it's like, I actually just did I do LinkedIn Lives every week, and the topic this week was creative solutions to burnout. But what I really wanted to call it was the top 10 dumb things smart people do to try to recover from burnout. And this is one of them. I'm burned out. I don't feel like I can handle all of the responsibility of this leadership position. And so the only thing left for me to do is to take a step down, is to basically demote myself, because that's the only way I'm going to be able to recover from burnout. It's not true, but it's kind of like the brain will tell you that there's no other way to do that other than to step down. And the heartbreaking thing, that's not a dumb thing, by the way, it's heartbreaking that actually happens, and it happens for women primarily. I don't know of any, there probably are some occasions where men, it's happened for men as well, but in my circles, it's the women who are having this happen. And we make these compromises with ourselves. We downgrade our careers. We downgrade our aspirations. And to go back to that Harvard Business Review article, the systems and structures are not set up to support a young woman or any woman, regardless of age, to be able to actualize, to be able to live into her fullest potential. They're just not set up. In fact, I would say that they're probably designed to not allow that.
It almost seems like, at least in my instance of that happening or observing it happen, it seems like with leadership positions, there's not, at least in some places, there's not always really training. It's almost like you just kind of matriculate into it, in a sense. So I wonder if that's also like a major contributor, because it's like you're expected to fulfill the role without having the coaching that's necessary to probably foster the best type of leadership.
Really smart. And in fact, who gets promoted into leadership positions are usually the technical experts, the rock stars who figure something out. And Elon Musk actually said in a tweet recently, he said that, all of his managers should be technical experts. And I don't disagree with that, but there are leadership qualities and characteristics, especially emotional intelligence. Moving into spiritual intelligence, I'm going to say in the next probably 7 to 10 years is going to be even more important than it is now. And emotional intelligence first, and then spiritual intelligence later on in the timeline. And, I think that you have to have a level of technical ability. You have to be proven to, you have to know the language, you have to know the thing, but you may not be the A+ number one student in that field, or the rock star in the field, but you're so good at drawing out the best in other people. You're so good at leveraging other people's strengths, abilities, and talents, but that takes training, and there are people who are innately leaders, but even we need refinement. We need to, just like a child prodigy still needs to have refinement if she's playing the piano or whatever, there still is training to be done. It just isn't that I don't have to teach you how to be a leader. You're already a leader. How can you actualize as a leader is the question that often needs to be answered. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it does make sense. Because I think there's so many instances where people are in that role, but they're not necessarily a good leader. It's just because of their qualifications, or because their seniority, or because of, like corporate favoritism, whatever reason, a lot of times.
They're getting rewarded because of all of this hard work they did on a project, rather than because they're actually the best, most qualified for the job of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The industry that I was in, and we won't name the industry yet, but I was there for 6 years, and rarely did women get, and this is not, by the way, for anybody that's listening, this is not an attack on white males. We support white males. We love white males. But it was interesting. It was like such this bro culture. And it was not even if you could do your job well, it was straight politics and the good old boys. And I think it's hard to talk about corporate. I have such a horrible taste in my mouth. Obviously, it's because of the industry that I was in. But yeah, it is difficult.
It's any wonder that you felt like an imposter if that was the environment.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I'm married to a white guy. Like, I don't like, that's not the
we
point.
Love
it's
em.
More like,
we love them.
Yeah. But the culture of it is, right. can be exclusionary.
Yes.
And what I find with women who move into those cultures, and I've worked with many of them who kind of, well, when Barb wrote the first edition of Smart Girls, she wrote it on my generation. So it was back in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was going through and getting my ACTs and all the things that I had to do. And that's the group that she wrote on first. And she was making observations on the culture at that time, which was basically that, you know, women would go into the workspace, into corporate with the big shoulder pads and the, you know, kind of working girl attitude. And I can't talk about my family, and I need to just basically take remedial masculinity lessons in order to achieve what I want to achieve in the corporate space. That hasn't changed too much, unfortunately, mm-hmm. in the ensuing, you know, 30 years since then. So I think that for those of us who are choosing to interact with and be in the corporate space as women, as leaders, as emotionally intelligent people, I think it's really important that we check in with ourselves. Where am I leaning into myself? How am I bringing my whole self to work? Some of my female executives who I work with who are interviewing for jobs still tell me they're afraid to talk about their families. I don't want them to think that I can't do the job because I'm taking care of my kids. When I was in my 20s and I was interviewing for my first positions in tech, I would make a point to say, and I'm not planning on having kids anytime soon. Like, really? That's what we had to do. Or that's what I thought I had to do. I'm not sure that I actually had to do that, but that's what I thought I had to do. Because I assumed that they were going to assume that, well, she's, you know, 26, she's probably going to, and she's married, she's probably going to have kids soon.
Mm-hmm. I think too, it's not just about being a woman in corporate culture. It's trying to keep the femininity about yourself being in the corporate world. Because I've noticed that, you know, a lot of the women that I was surrounded by just really carried masculine energy. And my energy, just me personally, my energy really shifted into this like masculine energy, trying to like fit into the corporate structure, which I think just has a masculine energy to it in general. Like it is a masculine energy. It's rigid, it's structured, and not saying that that's a bad thing, but that's hard to kind of mesh feminine energy into.
Well, you want to know what I told one of the women who worked with me who is very much in that masculine energy? I told her one time, and this was in, my clients call me the velvet hammer. So I just say things like they are.
I love that.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
Yeah. And I always say it with love, but I'm like, I said to her, I said, you can put your penis away.
Yes. Like, please get your penis out of my face. Tuck it away.
But that's what happens even energetically with some women. It's pretty heartbreaking, actually, that that's the extent that they will go to in order to be able to fit into this culture of into the bro culture, basically, is what you're talking about. So she took that to heart and understands that it just is to bring that, make what's unconscious more conscious. That's the point. Definitely. Because after she's got that information, now she can make a decision if she's going to actually do that or not. But she can't unknow that information. So I kind of do
hashtag
sorry,
can.
Not sorry. Like, so yeah. So I think that there are, oh, and I should say this too, that for gifted girls and women, and by giftedness, I mean people who process information quickly, make sense of things, and know what to do about them. So it's just basically IQ processing speed. But this research has been in for a long time, for generations. We've seen this, that gifted girls are more like average boys than they are like average girls. So we see smart girls hanging out with boys when they're kids, because there's no drama and there's, you know, they're just easier to play with and they're imaginative and all the things. And they're not so worried about that relational bullying stuff that continues to plague a lot of girls. So there's that kind of more, I'm going to call it androgynous because I don't know a better word for it, approach to life anyway, even if you lean into more of your femininity. There just is more of a balance, I think, of the masculine and feminine characteristics that you can definitely tip into one or the other. But that's even a conscious choice, I think. There may have been a day where you said, I think I'm going to kind of try on this new persona or this new energy just to see what happens with that.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, I think that's very relatable. I think that that definitely happens a lot. Getting into the energy, I just wanted to ask about toxic work environments as a result of narcissists in the workplace. I've gone through that several times, just experiencing it on different teams, and I've seen how it plays out and how it can just be a detriment to the entire team. Like, one person can just completely change the entire vibe of the team and just make that work environment so miserable. And I think it a lot of times can result in a lot of burnout or turnover if it's not addressed. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it isn't addressed because a lot of times they have those characteristics that set them up for success, in a sense, or at least they know how to get what they want because they're willing to do whatever it takes to get there. So I was just wondering about what you've experienced with that and if you've had to deal with that in helping others that are in the leadership positions.
You know, narcissism and any kind of personality disorder in leadership can be very, very toxic to the team, whether it is narcissism or it's a bipolar personality, I'm sorry, a borderline personality disorder, mm-hmm. or bipolar disorder can be another problem that goes undiagnosed, unidentified, and misunderstood within the leadership itself. And to your point, a lot of those characteristics, those kind of cutthroat, highly competitive, killer instincts that we see with the narcissist in particular, can be incredibly toxic in the organization and can lead to turnover. And the problem is, when I see that, it's often a leadership problem, mm-hmm. to not be able to address it. I wanted to share this with you because I just found this yesterday. I bought the book because there was one thing in it, and I'm like, oh, that's worth the price of admission. It's by Renee Evanson. I've never heard of her before, but I came across this last night. It's called Powerful Phrases for Dealing with Difficult People.
Ooh.
Oh, wow.
How to Deal with a Backstabber. How to Deal with a Brown Noser. How to Deal with a Bully. And she's got these scripts that obviously have certain language in. How to Make an Apology. How to Understand. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, everybody needs to have more words. There's a presence, there's a frequency on which you deliver the words. But even to have those just in your back pocket, some words, some language around dealing with difficult people, I think is important. It's very empowering. There's a whole chapter on powerful phrases for challenging situations with your boss. There are the basic rules when confronting your boss, how to deal with an abusive boss, how to deal with a controlling boss, an egotistical boss, and so on. So I'm just getting started on it, but seriously, like, who wouldn't want this book?
Amazing. Yeah. I want to know the answers to all of those.
I know. So I think that the more we, sometimes it's not an information problem. Sometimes it's an energy problem that we have. Sometimes it's a burnout problem that we have. But in this case, when you're talking about dealing with a narcissist personally, or being on a team who has a narcissist who's not, the leadership isn't addressing that, I think that sometimes it's information that you do need on what's the best way to address this. Because again, it's really hard to be a good leader and be a really nice person at the same time.
We're getting to about an hour and a half. So
talk about being in flow, and it's 3:33.
We're in the flow. Is it 3:33? I love that.
Yeah.
Flow state.
Yep.
Do you have any final words for our listeners?
A couple. One is, I think that we collectively need to become much more discerning about what we're allowing to have access to our consciousness. So whether it's how long I'm scrolling on social media, or what websites I'm looking at, or how often I'm going to Netflix, everything in our environment has subtle energies and subtle messages that are, we're constantly being bombarded with. Even this time that we have together, we're being bombarded by energies as well. Hopefully they're positive. Hopefully they're beneficial to us. Hopefully, my fingers are crossed. And I know that this conversation has been beneficial, at least to me, it has. Mm-hmm, and definitely. Because I've been in flow the whole time and I'm like, wow, it's an hour and a half.
I know.
So I just think that the discernment piece, especially for intuitives, for people who are awake, aware of what's going on, and also to keep asking questions. I think that that'll be the death of us when we stop asking questions. Mm-hmm. So anytime something that pops up for me that seems weird, I'm going to pay attention to. And I will share this last anecdote with you as an example. Right before we in Arizona got sent home, so this was in March of 2020, I was at yoga class. It was probably the last yoga class I went to until we were only closed for a couple of months. But it was the last yoga class I went to as a substitute teacher. Had never had her before. At the yoga studio I always go to. So we get through the whole yoga class. We're in Shavasana at the end. And I'm laying there and I'm relaxed and I'm kind of zoned out. And all of a sudden she says, in the middle of her meditation, as she's closing out the class, she says, "And remember, you're just a cog in a great machine." And that was a moment where I woke up and I'm like, what just came out of her mouth? And that was one of the first signals that there was a matrix and there was a glitch in it. And I have used that story as inspiration for everything that I do when I'm talking to people in the corporate space, when I'm talking to entrepreneurs, to remember that you're not a cog in a great machine and you're not a robot and you're not a clone. You're a human being. Your greatest gift is your emotions. Your greatest gift is creativity, your capacity to create something new, unique, useful. And I think the more that we wake up to that and the more that we're asking those questions about what can I contribute and what can I master, those are going to be the things that get us through this very challenging time that we're living in. And don't go back to sleep. That's the last thing I will say. Stay awake. Stay awake.
Love it. And where can our listeners find you?
I'm on social media, of course. I spend some time on LinkedIn because that's where my people are. And can you just search for me on LinkedIn? I think we can put that in the show notes too, but I think it's my name, Robin McKay. And then the number one, I think that's my LinkedIn I've had LinkedIn from like 2007 or something. And then Instagram at dr.robinmckay is my Instagram. And then on my website, drrobinmckay.com, drrobinmckay.com. If you just hover there for a couple seconds, there's a quiz that comes up and it's a leadership styles quiz. It's a small segment of that bigger personality assessment I was talking to you about, the NEO, and it really gives you a clear sense of what your personality, or sorry, what your leadership style is based on your personality. And then it even dives deeper than that and says, based on what your that style is, what's your soul purpose given your style of leadership? So that's a really, I always want to say it's a fun quiz. I don't know if it's a fun quiz, but it is informative and meaningful. And if that's what you're after, I would go check that out.
Love it.
Yes, me too. And I feel like I took it for some reason a little
while. I think we did. Okay. Are you ready for our last question?
I am ready for the last question.
Okay. What is one song that penetrates your soul?
Oh, well, that's easy. This makes me cry. Oh my gosh. The song that I've had in my heart from the time I was a little girl is Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Judy Garland sang it in The Wizard of Oz. Then my sisters and I sang it at my dad's second wedding. And then I was in Paris at Montmartre, the cathedral, and somebody was playing his guitar and singing it. And then I walked down the aisle to Somewhere Over the Rainbow. That's my song.
Oh, that's so amazing. Yeah, so I love it. I love when people give like a really quick response. They're like, I know exactly what song.
Yeah.
We will add it to our playlist.
That's it. The Iz version, the Hawaiian singer Iz.
Oh, yes.
That's my favorite. That's
like, rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. He just speaks to my soul, that Hawaiian spirit. So, and thanks for making me cry. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bringing tears to my eyes. That's a good one. Great question. It was so good to be here with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Level complete. Hit subscribe, like, and leave a review for future.